Welcome back, everyone, to the Reflex Blues Show. I brought back Joe. Now, Joe, you've been on the show back. I had to look it up a couple times in season three.
Mm-hmm.
Back when you were working for superstar designer Drew Davies, registered trademark Andrew Davies, who's now, I think we need to change it to like superstar president designer. Now he's like co-president of AIJ National.
Yeah, what's the maximum level? Because he's about there.
Well, I think removing the co is the maximum level.
Mm-hmm.
But as when we had Drew on the show a few episodes ago to talk about you know, running the organization into the ground or whatever he's doing, I think we also realized that for Omaha, co-president might be the max. I thought national board would be the maximum for that they would ever allow from Omaha. So, but due to weird circumstances, somehow Omaha got a co-president. So that might be it. That might be the match.
Well, Drew, he heard you say that, and he's like, well, Donovan's not going to tell me what to do.
Well, I'm just saying it's great. It's great for Omaha.
It is.
It's great for Nebraska. And it's actually good for the chapter because I think he's going to do a great job.
Yeah. Drew cares about AIGA more than anybody I've ever met. It's pretty amazing.
All right. So since then, though, I mentioned this because you have since left the Oxide family after almost co-founding it, because you were with them. You were the first employee there.
Mm-hmm. I'm an honorary co-founder.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And how long were you there?
Almost 9 years.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, we thought you would just retire there, but you've actually just left, and since then, I think you now just make your living tweeting or something.
I tweet occasionally. I try to tweet once a day, and even that's kind of difficult. I've spent most of my time over the last year and a half teaching and doing some freelance and kind of spinning up to doing more problem solving professionally as a teacher and finding ways to do that.
And we're gonna talk about first is, since we've talked a lot off mic even about how you started hashtag like problem solving.
Yeah, actually the first tweet I ever tweeted I used hashtag solve problems, because that was the title of my blog post.
Oh, I thought the solve problems was a shortening of it, because you realized
it. Well, and then from my second tweet to maybe my 50th, I was using problem solving as the hashtag, because it seemed to make more sense, like you're defining a category. And then I realized that if I go back to solve problems, that not only is it more a command, like it's a little more engaging, but it's also one character shorter. And so because
in
my
Twitter,
tweets,
those characters are important.
They're really valuable. Yeah.
And so what is it? What is solve problems? Cause you've kind of started this new movement, and now this is kind of being this umbrella thing that you're doing. And when you mean solve problems, it's kind of solving them with a design mindset as well.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
It is, right.
This isn't like solving a crossword puzzle. It's solving something using design or design thinking.
It is, yeah. So my interest in problem solving started really early in my life, but I didn't realize that that's what it was. And as a designer, and especially at Oxide, focusing on the process of design and realizing that there are some steps that you can follow in order to find a solution that you're really satisfied with and that meets the goals of the project, I realized that process is not only really interesting to me because it's so effective, but I think that there's a potential of using it in your personal life to make decisions that are not design decisions. And so when I made that connection that I've actually been doing that unintentionally for a long time, and realizing how effective the process was as a person, I wanted to just start communicating about that. And
so tell us one of the things that you did in your personal life that with this solve problems philosophy.
Well, I am right now, I'm choosing grad school to go to. I'm going to apply to grad school pretty soon, and then I'm hoping to start in the fall. And so that process ends up being really effective for deciding, first of all, why do I want to go to school? What are the goals? What are the things that I want to attain from that? And then focusing on those goals in order to choose the right school. And then also combining that with the fact that I'm going to be moving, which means I need to end up in a city that I want to live in.
Yeah, because we'll throw out there that even though Omaha, you know, is this hotbed of design, and we have a co-president of AI Janel. There's still only like one program, and even it's an hour away, that actually has a design master's.
So I think, honestly, I've spent so much time in Omaha, and I feel really good about Omaha, but I'm ready for a new experience that I would move anyway. But I'm kind of excited by the fact that I have to move. And so I'm going to move to a totally different city so that I can have a brand new experience. I could go to Iowa State. They have a master's program, but
and I've heard good things about the program.
It's a great program.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I looked at it briefly, but, only as a compromise between trying to stay where I am and get a master's degree. And then I decided, based on my goals as a person, the problem solving process, that moving to a bigger city and getting rid of my car and just kind of living life in a brand new place could be really good for me.
Oh, we wish you all the best. So now we're also talking about the solve problems because you've just launched, or we assume you've just launched this website. It's in progress as we record this, but through the magic of not releasing these live, where do people go to find the new kind of the manifesto about the solve problems?
It is at solveproblems.tm.
Ooh, and was the .tm a was that solving the problem that the .com was taken?
Yeah, right. And the .org. I contacted the guy who owned the .org, and he evidently has some plans for it. So hopefully, it's not too close to what my plans are. I settled on TM because there's a TM in the logo, and I've been using the option 2 on my keyboard a lot to trademark things, and I've been having a lot of fun with that. And I realized that visually it does a really good job of marking this logo as something kind of official and important and intentional. And then it also, philosophically, the TM means it's taking ownership of an idea.
Well, I will say from a problem-solving perspective that solveproblems.tm, I might remember, where solveproblems.net, I was just still typing the .com. I think .nets are just the worst.
That's a good bonus point, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I would only buy a .net if you already own the .com because they're painful.
It's pretty embarrassing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like meaning, yeah, we couldn't get the .com.
Right.
The .tm looks like that's what you wanted.
Yeah, that's good. All right. That's good feedback.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about the first venture off of the Solve Problems website, which is Night School. And we're back. So the first venture from the Solve Problems umbrella is you're discussing there's going to be a Solve Problems night school.
Mm-hmm.
What is this? I mean, do I have to enroll?
No, not really. There's going to be an RSVP for it, which you can access through solveproblems.tm. So night school is actually a solution in itself. I've been teaching for 2.5 years now. Including when I was still with Oxide, I was teaching at night. And I had a really good experience with my class, and so I was communicating about it to a lot of professionals. And there were a few people who asked about taking my class. And I've had a couple of really good friends who have taken my class and had a really good experience, but I feel like there's a lot of potential for bringing all professionals together rather than having students mixed in with professionals. So night school is an opportunity to take the classroom experience and solving problems in a sort of open and non-pressurized environment, but also working with your peers and getting feedback on your work. So night school is taking the classroom experience and turning it into something that professionals can do to help just become better problem solvers and to to work with each other a little bit more often.
And are these going to be housed wherever you are? So like the up until the fall, they'll be housed in Omaha, and then wherever you end up at, it gets moved?
I'm not sure.
Once a month to do it in Omaha forever.
All of those are potentials. I really don't know. I'm hoping that night school can continue on after I leave. And I have some good friends who are at least interested in the idea of taking it over. I also want it to be a pretty low management.
So you might be able to franchise this. So if someone's interested, they should just go to your website and franchise a night school.
Right. Yes. Okay. That's a great idea. Yeah. I'm actually, I love the idea of just spreading this format around. I haven't heard of anything like this. It probably exists somewhere, but this is something that I've wanted as a person for a while, and I've gotten really good feedback on the idea from my friends.
So, like, we do the once a month 36 pints where we just meet at the bar.
Yeah.
But this is meet at the bar but show work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know that it's going to be in the same location every month, but it's probably going to be in an environment that gives us a little bit more room to move around and to stick some sticky notes up on the wall. So, the location is not determined yet, but the format is going to be people. There's at least two different parts. The first part is people show up and we all sort of gather in the same space. And then there are about five people who are planning to show work. And so they show something that they're working on, and then they ask specific questions of the audience to get some feedback on it. So it's sort of like a critique, but a little friendlier because you're asking questions you want feedback on. And then you have a bunch of really smart, creative people to give you that feedback.
Oh, sure.
So, yeah. So that's the first part. And then the second part is I would like to give some kind of lesson on problem solving. So I don't know how involved that's going to be, but I would like to sort of just like facilitate the discussion and offer some kind of advice about solving problems. While I have everybody in the same room. And then the third part is a problem-solving exercise where we all solve the same problem. And in order to keep the maintenance of night school pretty low, I would like the solutions to be kind of open-ended. So we come up with a bunch of solutions. We potentially agree on which ones are the best ones. And then anyone who wants to take that and run with it and actually implement it, they're free to do that. But we'll sort of, as night school, we'll sort of like close the book on that problem, and then we'll do a different one next month.
Well, I look forward to seeing how these venture out, and hopefully, and I assume on your website or somewhere, where do people go to find out, like, will there be any recaps of all, or like any sort of, this is where we're moving forward? Is it just going to be also on the solveproblems.tm?
Yep. It'll be there in some capacity. I don't know how soon, but that is my plan. I want to build this site into, I want it to encapsulate all of my professional ventures, which includes all the cool stuff we do at night school.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Now, I have to ask you a little off topic here. You're probably, out of Omaha, maybe the most quoted designer, is what I've read. But I think it's only one quote that ever gets quoted from you.
Yeah.
And that is, let me see if I can remember it, because I've seen it a lot. And it's, good design is obvious. Great design is transparent.
That's right.
So great design is like invisible. It doesn't exist.
If a problem is solved really well, then it appears as if there was never a problem there in the first place.
Was there like a stroke? Like you're on your way to work and you're like, I get it. It's like transparent, or is it just something that kind of evolved over time, or how'd you come to this concept?
That concept came from designing professionally for clients, and I don't remember the project itself, but so I think it was sort of assembled over time. But the same thing happens pretty frequently designing for other people, especially when they're paying you for it, is that there's an expectation from the designer side and from the client side that the design should feel very valuable visually, so that you can see this is what I paid for.
Right.
So very often, a solution to a problem is really efficient and may not appear very valuable, but it can still be very thoughtful and a perfect solution to that problem. So it really, that quote is about the general tendency of graphic design to be more ornate than it needs to be. Okay. And that sometimes those things that are added to it just to appear that they're expensive.
Well, I also think it's not only the ornate nature, but it's also sometimes like the amount of buttons that are on a form and stuff like this. Because mm-hmm. I did a, years ago, we were doing a website for somebody and we had a special feature and we just did a wireframe. We hadn't done anything visually. We're just showing them, these are the fields, here's how it'll work.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in there and I showed it to him and from, you know, I was in the human factors department years ago and stuff. So I kind of worked with these people. And when I show them the solution, they're like, that's it? It's like, that's, yep. No, it was far, it's like much more work than you think to get it right. Down to where there's only like two buttons on a page and there's only like right. Three things they fill out. This was not, and I think they would have been happier if I would have just jammed in a bunch of other stuff that, mm-hmm. that would have made it confusing.
Right. Yeah. And that's understandable. You, paying for something, you want to feel like your money is well spent, and it's hard to articulate sometimes to clients how effective a solution is when it appears very simple.
That is why the best solution is always just Helvetica Bold 185 with all caps.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and that's my quote. All right, we'll be right back with more Joe. Welcome back. Now, we were kind of talking, I mean, the reason you're going to grad school is so that you can do more teaching, I assume.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And because we're in this weird profession where, and it's probably why there's very few places that offer masters compared to like undergrads in this degree,
mm-hmm.
is this is like the one profession where you only get a master's if you're going to teach.
Mm-hmm.
Where other places you get a master's to learn more, to like move forward in your field.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a couple people on the show in the past that have gotten masters to further their career, but it's rare. I mean, mm-hmm. I would say my guess is 90% of the people that graduate with a master's do it so they can teach.
I think so.
These are just rough guesses. I mean, yeah. You know.
It's hard to justify professionally. It's expensive, and most employers will never ask.
No, and I know, like, I've taught in a couple places here in town, and you've taught at a couple places. And if you're an adjunct faculty, that's why, like, it was weird because I was telling somebody that, oh yeah, I'm just teaching a class, and they're like, I want to teach, and they're a business person or they're in marketing, and they go and talk to the same school I'm at, and they're like, no, you need an MBA, and they're like, why doesn't it require for your field? And I'm like, because nobody has them.
yeah.
So I mean, if you're just adjunct faculty or part-time,
mm-hmm.
it's either work experience or four-year degree, or even some places two-year degree is fine.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually are going back to school to, like, because you want to actually do this.
Yeah. I have been teaching for 2.5 years. I started at Metropolitan Community College.
You came in like probably just after I left, because I taught there for about 4 years.
Yeah, I'm kind of disappointed we never had the overlap.
Well, it's weird.
Faculty
at
together.
That, at that campus, I always taught at the Fort campus, and maybe there was someone teaching in the room next to me. But no, most of the time, no, I'd walk in.
Yeah.
That campus just set up to where you walk in, there's no one else in the building,
mm-hmm.
so we probably wouldn't run into each other anymore.
Yeah, that's true. But I could feel the presence of Donovan, I think.
Yeah, you'd be like, who messed up all the files on the computer? Who's messing with the server?
So I've been teaching
Tell
at Metro.
Your students, who taught you that? Who should stop doing that?
And I've been teaching at Creighton then just this semester, and then I'll teach again.
See, that's
next
where
semester.
I started. That's where my first. Just, my
I'm
first
doing the reverse Donovan plan.
Yeah, there you go.
What was your question?
Oh yeah, why are you going full time? I mean, what was the appeal? Because you were at one of the hottest shops in all of the design mecca of Omaha.
Yeah. I really enjoyed my time at Oxide, and I learned a lot from from Drew and from Adam. And, you know, some days I miss that collaborative design environment. But working with our interns and then doing portfolio reviews and visiting schools as a professional, I found my connection to design is through that experience of working with younger people who are kind of discovering what design is and how they communicate with it and helping them do that as effectively as possible. And then also kind of correcting the things about my education that I was disappointed by, the things that I learned as a professional.
Oh, you did take my class.
It was hard to tell because you were never there.
Oh, yeah, there you go, there you go.
Like I mentioned earlier, the process of design at Oxide and any place that does it correctly is it's a pretty straightforward process, but it's not something that I learned as a student. And I like the opportunity of explaining to students the really valuable lessons from my career and getting them started much earlier than I did on that curve, because it's pretty steep learning curve.
What's the biggest thing you think you learned at Oxide that you wish that you would have learned in school? Because certain things you'll never learn in school, but like, what is the thing you thought you should have?
Well, there are a few. Can I have a few?
Yeah.
Okay. So the big one is having goals. When you start solving a problem, you should know at the end of it, this is where I'd like to end up.
Oh, like design goals, not how much cash you want to make in this profession.
Right.
Okay.
Well, yeah, but problem solving as a person, that could be your goal. That's fine.
Just do crappier work, you'll make more money. Spend less time on it.
Right. That's an easy solution.
I need to make more money.
That's why I'm going to grad school, though.
All right, there you go.
Having a goal in design is generally a communication goal, something that you want your design to communicate to other people who look at it. So having goals is one. Another one is inspiration. As you're designing, you should be looking at things that solve a similar problem or communicate similar things, and that will inevitably help you solve your problem better. Even though the things you're looking at are different, the context is different, you can gain a lot from looking at how other people solve problems.
Okay.
And then the third one is collaboration, which is really fun to do in class, which is just being willing to share your ideas with other people and get feedback on those. It will make your work so much better.
Well, I always tell students, because you know, you do a portfolio review and they always flip and like, well, this is a group project. It's like, that's great. You actually don't be ashamed of that, because even though you didn't do all the work, most work in this profession is not done. Is not done outside of a group. And even if you're just freelancing, your client's part of your group, because they're going to give you feedback.
Yeah, right. The client experience, especially. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think every now and then you hear of some group projects in school, and I think they probably need more of them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I integrate collaboration into my classes as often as possible. Usually once a week we do some kind of collaboration exercise. And now the students...
And it's not just tearing each other down. It's actually like helping collaboration.
Yeah. I try to facilitate collaboration that is... That doesn't feel like I'm setting students up to be criticized, and more to help them solve a problem or make a decision that they're having trouble with. So just today, actually at Creighton, we did... a collaboration exercise where students sort of set up their problem at the beginning. They said, so here's what I'm working on. These are the things I'm thinking about. And then they said, I have this question that I need help with. And so then all of the other students will attempt to solve that sort of smaller problem within the midst of the big problem on a sticky note. And then we collect all those together and then we look at them up on screen. And what you find, the reason that it works so well, is that each student only has to contribute one idea, and almost always every student has one idea to contribute, and then we get to see 10 or 12 ideas on screen within a couple of minutes.
Well, I remember like Paul Birkbigler, when he was teaching in the area, he had a project where I think he did, the first project was like, you do a logo, and I forget the exact details, but the second project was stationary set, but you used another student's logo. And I was like, I always thought
that was great
because it's kind of collaborating, because you're working with someone else's work, but that's so real world.
It is. Oh, I like that.
So yeah, because you're like, wow, if it's good or bad, it doesn't matter. It's what the client has. That's their mark. That's their identity. You just gotta go with it.
That's right.
He said he got a little. I think if I remember right, a couple of the students were mad because they're like, the logo was in someone else's book because it's on their stationery. It's like, hey,
yep.
It becomes very obvious when you see the whole book whether or not they actually did. You know?
Right. Right. In the end, it's not that relevant if it doesn't stand out as seeming like work they didn't do.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be right back and we'll wrap the show up. All right, I guess we're going to bring it back because since you're in the faculty profession, we used to always do like a student tip.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we used to do a taboo typeface too. You got a taboo typeface? Is there a font that we should bail on?
I believe that there is a context out there for probably every typeface.
So your taboo typeface is anything that doesn't fit into the context of what it looks like?
Yes, right. That's much better said. Yep.
Okay. All right. That's kind of weak, I mean, but we'll go with it. So, and then... Since you're moving towards, I mean, you've done quite a bit of education, and you even did like a summer class for like younger people. Like,
oh, I did.
Wasn't necessarily, I mean, it wasn't really designed per se because they would maybe the word, but
yeah, no, I'm glad you brought this up actually. So my long term,
this was part of the reason. If I remember, we had lunch one time, and you were telling us about it, and I think it was part of the reason that led to where you're at.
It was the first experiment in realizing my long-term goal. So solve problems as an organization, a very loose, non-affiliated organization, I eventually want to teach people about problem solving in order to use those skills in their regular life to make better decisions. And I really would love to help kids use that skill. So that at a...
What's the kid's age? Because I've got like a 14-month-old, and I don't think she understands. Maybe she'll be 15 months old by the time. So she's technically a toddler, but she's not going to use any design skills.
Yeah, probably not. I'll let you know if I get there.
Okay, what's the kid range you talk about?
I'm thinking middle school.
Okay.
At an age where they're... Honestly, I think it's a really good blend of still being a kid. So they're willing to just... speak their mind and be creative without being self-conscious about it. But they're right at the crux of their life where they're starting to make decisions that will have long-term impacts. And teaching them how to make decisions in order to solve problems could have a lot of real value for them.
Okay. And so what was the class that you taught?
It was through Metro. They have... a program called College for Kids every summer where anyone can actually propose a class and then teach a week-long class to either elementary or middle school kids. And so mine was middle school, and I pitched a class about problem solving. And I was sort of using my experience as a teacher in order to get my foot in the door, but I had never taught problem solving to kids before that moment. So I wasn't sure how it was going to go. But it went really well, and we did some sketching, and we worked with twist ties and Legos, and I had them install little piano apps on their phones, and we played music to express different emotions, and then the students had to guess which emotion went with which song. And I gave them little problem solving exercises each day for 5 days. The classes were 2 hours long. And it was so much fun that I knew that my long-term goal was realistic, and that it was something that I enjoyed doing so much that that I could really start focusing intensely on that.
No, that's wonderful. So what is the advice you gave those junior high kids? Like, was there anything you gave them as advice, like as a parting wisdom, or like run, like go into healthcare, I don't know.
Well, I gave them, each day I gave them a different problem solving strategy. And I think that maybe the most important one for them was setting goals and establishing, just like I tell my students in my classes, just establishing right now what you would like to happen at the end of any kind of scenario, and then using that as the foundation for, okay, now I have a problem to solve. This is where I want to get to. So what decisions can I make to get there?
No, that's great. And what kind of advice would you give to like the students in your class now?
The same thing. But I can explain that from a design context. It's very, very common. I don't do a lot of portfolio reviews anymore, but when I did, it's very common to sit down with a student and have them explain their work and to not have rationale for their decisions, to not be able to say...
You mean, it just looks cool, dude.
Right.
Like, this looks awesome.
Right. Right.
Or epic or whatever the
term is. Yeah, whatever the most current word is.
Yeah.
Yeah, honestly, yeah, exactly. It's very common for students to explain their design decisions in a way that has no bearing on the problem that they're solving, because they weren't solving one. They didn't sit down and say, okay, so I'm designing for this company. This is what they do. This is what I want this billboard or logo or whatever to communicate. They don't do that. And so their design decisions are, I think, not necessarily, it's not the student's fault, but their design decisions don't have a basis in communicating something specific. And so, of course, they're going to say, because it looks cool, or, oh, I saw that and I really wanted to try it. And so whatever the next project was that came up, I just did that thing. It's not their fault. I think it's really the school and the faculty's responsibility to teach them how important it is.
Now, I'll say, if you have an idea where you're like, I want to do this, I want to try it, I never say don't do it, but it's always like, you got to wait. So we, you know, a few years ago, we had something where, actually, it was more recent than that, but the other designer was like, I want to do this, it's going to look cool. I was like, it's not going to work. I mean, that is not the solution for this client, but I guarantee you, you know, but we can do that.
Yeah.
And then a couple projects later, it's like, all right, this is it.
Yeah.
It's like, and I got it, really? And it's like, yes, this is the proper client. This is the proper project. That solution, it's a go.
Good for you. Yeah.
But you have to, I always say, you know, it's like, I would say to the students, like, don't not do that solution. Just hold it in your back pocket.
Yeah.
Because when it hits right, it's going to work better.
Right. I mean, so talking about taboo typefaces, Comic Sans was designed for a Microsoft application that I used originally that was really cool. That was a chat program where you chat with other people, and then on the fly, the program builds a little comic strip. And then your chat goes in the talk bubble above your character's head. And it was really neat. And in that context, Comic Sans is a great solution.
And I'll say that I think we even mentioned this on, might have even been like the Be a Design cast or something way back when, is when the movie Sin City came out. Mm-hmm. So the Comic Sans typeface was based on the letter forms from The Dark Knight Returns and from the Watchmen comic, those two comics. And then Sin City was done by Frank Miller, who now in Sin City actually just used, I think he did all the lettering himself. The original comics he did.
Okay.
But it's kind of based on, did The Dark Knight, so it's the same guy.
Right.
So when they did the Sin City movie, all the posters were in Comic Sans, but in that context,
yeah,
it actually, I was like, I want to hate it, but I know that it's actually dead on because I have the original Sin City comic books and it looks right.
That's the right solution to that.
The only other right solution would be to Frank to rewrite everything, but I know that, you know, he's not going to do that for a movie poster, so.
Yeah.
There are solutions. Now, I'll ask you one last question. What's the best advice you've ever gotten about design?
Oh.
Not that you would give, but like, and I just say this because I remember, because, you know, we're talking about Drew. Nicholas here in the office, he mentioned, because we had some job shadow come through and they were asking questions and stuff, and he goes, I'll just give the advice I went in when I talked to Drew one day, which was, it was something along the lines of, you can't help but not love doing this. Because, I mean, if you're doing this for the money or something, you're in the wrong
way. Right.
But right. you, if you're going to be a designer, you have to love it.
That was the right advice for Burroughs.
Yeah.
I right now in my life, I'm pretty excited about grad school.
Okay.
And becoming a better teacher and moving to the next phase of my life as a professional. And I think the best advice that I've gotten, at least in the last year, was that grad school was the next thing that I should do. And before before Tim Guthrie told me that, I hadn't considered it. And now I don't think like there's, I don't believe there's any other option. I think that that is the next thing that I have to do, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, no, we look forward to it. We'll follow you on solveproblems.tm. Find out more information. I think the best advice I got was get out before you get used to the money, which I think my coworker told me about every day after I was there for a certain amount of time until I was like, fine, I'll get out.
I've never had that problem.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a tough one to get because sometimes places will pay you well enough to where you want to stay, but you know, you long term, it's probably not where you want to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Donovan.
Well, thanks, Joe. We'll be back soon. I think I said this was going to be the finale, but we're doing one more. We're going to do one more show, and then we're going to wrap up season six, and we'll be back sometime next year in 2014 after that. So we'll be back in a couple weeks. See you then.
Thanks for listening to the Reflex Blue Show. For more information, visit 36point.com. The Reflex Blue Show was created by Donovan Beery and Nate Voss. Music by Ben Luders.